It is September 2021, and I'm Heidi James, and welcome to Write on Prime. As usual, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Dr. Vanessa Carty, and we are here to guide you through another episode of Ooey Gooey Good, Primary Care, Continuing Medical Education.
It's great to be here as usual, Heidi, and what's new in your world?
Well, Vanessa, we've talked about this before, but this is my favorite time of year. I love the fall. The leaves are starting to change colors and the kids are back in schools. Another thing about September is that it is sickle cell month.
And that's exactly why I wanted to discuss this case. Now, this wasn't someone I saw up north, but when I worked in a larger and more multicultural center. So this was a four-year-old male patient of African-American descent who, unfortunately, had sickle cell disease.
Ooh, that is a tough diagnosis. Had this little kiddo already had a rough course so far by the time you'd seen him?
Yeah, unfortunately, he really had. He'd had a stroke at the age of three, as well as frequent and very intense sickle cell pain crises.
Oh, that's awful. And where were you seeing him? Were you seeing him in the emergency department or was he admitted?
No, actually, in neither of those places. I was seeing him in the family medicine office. He was totally stable when I saw him, thankfully, and he was having a good day. But his mom and his dad had brought him in so that we could chat about ways to prevent him from having another stroke.
You mentioned the earlier stroke when he was three. Had that stroke left him with deficits?
Well, he didn't have any motor issues, but he seemed to have some language difficulties, and an MRI had shown areas of brain ischemia, which was just brutal to consider when you think of this little guy already having these challenges.
Yeah, and you can, of course, understand why his parents would want to do anything possible to prevent another stroke. And I'm curious, did they come to you looking for the answers, or did they come prepared with some ideas of their own, as so many parents of kids with conditions do?
Luckily for me and for this little boy, his parents came prepared. They had been informing themselves about sickle cell in every possible way, and they were really, truly experts on the subject. So I was the one who learned a lot during our meeting.
I just want to do a quick little recap on sickle cell disease, Vanessa, because it's something that if we don't care for a lot of people with it, we might forget some of the details. So it is an autosomal recessive disorder that causes the red blood cells to become sickle in shape, then therefore have a shorter lifespan. We see it predominantly in people of African descent, but in the U.S., there are increasing number of Hispanic patients with the genes as well.
In terms of the pathophysiology of how all this happens, it used to be presumed that the sickled shape of the red blood cell caused them to get stuck in the smaller vessels, and then that would lead to ischemia further downstream. But apparently, it's even more complicated than that. It seems that there is a multifactorial process involved with inflammation and cellular factors, which is never a good sign when you see that combination. And so all of this contributes to the viscosity and the ischemia.
And anytime I think of sickle cell, I remember that one lecture in med school where they extolled the virtues of having sickle cell trait. Now, not sickle cell disease, but refresh our memories. What is potentially good about having the trait?
Those with the sickle cell trait, as opposed to the full sickle cell disease, as you mentioned, are conferred immunity to Plasmodium falciparum malaria, which is probably the only good thing about sickle cell genes, because otherwise they tend to wreak havoc. Do you remember some of the nasty things that can happen to these patients with sickle cell disease?
There are the vaso-occlusive crises and the intense, severe pain that these can cause. And people with sickle cell are also at high risk of severe and acute anemia, acute chest syndrome, and, as with your little guy here, stroke.
And we really need to recognize these things when they happen and treat them quickly. But perhaps even more importantly for the patient's life as a whole is, of course, how to prevent some of these things from happening. And I don't remember being taught much about this back in my training. The focus was always more about, you know, how to treat the pain aggressively and providing emotional support to the patient and the family. But in the outpatient clinic, we have a chance to sort of try and deal with some preventative issues. And my patient's family in this case really opened my eyes to a whole other area of prevention for sickle cell kids, namely a way to screen for and then hopefully intervene to prevent strokes. This is actually done by an annual transcranial Doppler, which looks for signs of elevated cerebral vascular flow. And for those who show high cerebral vascular flow rates, they can be offered periodic transfusions of red blood cells. And this has been shown to decrease the risk of stroke. In fact, in the initial studies, there was a 90% relative decline in the rate of stroke for those who were tested and underwent transfusion.
Wow, 90% is very impressive. Definitely nothing to sneeze at.
It certainly isn't. And the initial study in the late 1990s was actually stopped because the difference between the intervention and control groups was so vast that it was considered unethical not to offer the screening and treatment to all the patients in the age group. And this is for kids over the age of two.
Now, the 1990s was a while ago.
I'm too sexy for my shirt.
So why are we just really visiting this topic now?
Well, it's likely multifactorial, but it's probably largely due to the fact that sickle cell disease primarily affects people of African American and African descent, and also some Hispanic populations. And this is a group of patients that are already chronically underserved in most healthcare systems. So unfortunately, the fact that this screening tool isn't more widely offered is perhaps not surprising given our current healthcare context.
I imagine that this is something that might not be readily available in smaller centers like where you work and where I work. Bigger centers may already have these screenings set up, but not all the time.
Exactly. And there are some studies coming out of the States where they were looking, and even in some of the big cities, one hospital might offer this, but another hospital might not. Or one insurance system might offer it and another not. So there could be families living almost side by side who access different healthcare facilities and who have access to different screening. And then some families have not even heard of the screening.
Now, you mentioned this test should be done annually. Should it be done from birth onwards, or is there different guidance than that?
So the American Society of Hematology actually recommends the following. They recommend annual transcranial Dopplers of children over the age of 2 and up into adulthood to assess for the risk of stroke, whether the strokes be silent or otherwise. And I really like their emphasis on the silent strokes because, you know, these kids might be having learning difficulties, they might be having language difficulties, and they may not be able to access school-based resources to help them. But if they are shown to have had silent strokes or to be at risk of them, it could really increase their access to these resources. Now, for kids between the ages of 2 to 16 years with abnormal transcranial Dopplers, the American Society of Hematology recommends monthly blood transfusions if it's possible to do so safely. And then for kids ages 2 to 16 years with sickle cell disease and abnormal scans, but who live in low resource settings where regular blood transfusion therapy is not necessarily an option, then they recommend initiating hydroxyurea therapy. And for kids over the age of 2 and up into adulthood who present with acute stroke, the American Society of Hematology again suggests that we consider transfusing red blood cells without waiting for subspecialty consults or a CT scan to confirm a definitive diagnosis. And I think that is perhaps one of the most useful recommendations from a society that I have ever seen, because it gives you all the different possibilities depending on your practice setting. It's so great when the big societies realize that not all patients live next to an academic institution and they don't necessarily have access to insurance for medications. And so, armed with this information that the parents spoon-fed to me, after I did a bit of research, I was able to send in the requisition for the transcranial Doppler, and my patient was accepted no problem. Now, what's really such a shame is that sickle cell patients aren't automatically grouped into some sort of registry where follow-up could be coordinated, and that they don't have to each individually seek out these tests. But hopefully by getting the word out there, we'll see more and more patients getting screened, and the risk of strokes decreasing markedly in these kids.
Thanks for sharing this, Vanessa. I mean, very appropriate given that it's sickle cell month, but also very appropriate to remind us that we need to follow up with these families.
It was really a pleasure. And I think it's a really good reminder, given that it is sickle cell awareness month, to remember to ask our patients if they've even heard of this before and if it's ever been offered to them.
If you want to hear even more about sickle cell, go back to MRAP June, where Mel does an interview with a mom who has kids with sickle cell disease. And also he and Stuart share a little bit more information on managing sickle cell. And on that note, let's talk about what's on the rest of the show.
We have a great lineup this month, Heidi. You continue your chat with Hobie about thyroid medications, and then you and I tackle the rarely discussed issue known as treatment-induced neuropathy of diabetes. On The Generalist, Andrew Bilt covers new COPD guidelines, while the rural med case this month is a new take on a classic quandary: to treat the patient or their labs.
Last but certainly not least, Steve and Ken are back with their in-depth reviews of 10 primary care papers. September is jam-packed full of educational goodness, so let's dive in.